Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program Peter James. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Vic. It's good to be back.
Peter, how ironic that your new book is a book about making a movie, and you're just down the road from Hollywood, aren't you?
I am indeed. I'm actually in Beverly Hills right now.
That's amazing. What an amazing coincidence. And you used to work in the movies.
Yeah, I had. I've either written or produced some 26 films, most of them very forgettable. But they gave me, really it was working with a lot of high-profile actors that gave me the idea for this novel, for Not Dead Yet. Over the years, I've worked with quite a number of A-list stars. I mean, ranging from way back from Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, Peter Sellers, to more recently Sharon Stone, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino. And with a few exceptions, a lot of them do have kind of a massive ego. And they both crave adulation, and at the same time, they want to be protected from their adoring public. So it's kind of rather schizophrenic existence. And I thought it'd be interesting to write a novel about celebrity stalking. I had a stalker myself, and still do, for the past 10 years, so I had some direct experience of it.
You have a stalker?
Yeah. I had this lady. I do a lot of talks in England in particular. I'm very protective of independent bookstores and libraries. I do probably every other week I do a talk somewhere in the UK in an independent bookstore or a library. And about 10 years ago, I was doing a talk up in Newcastle. And there was this woman, she kept kind of looking at me and smiling at me like she was my best friend. And I thought, don't recognize you, but maybe you'll come up and say hi at the end, buy a book.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't. She just sort of vanished, sort of vaporized and like a ghost. And about 2 weeks later, I was down in Bristol, the other end of the country. And there was a woman sitting there, and I thought she looked just like that one up in Newcastle. And again, she just vanished at the end. And then about 3 weeks later, I was in the east of England, in Suffolk, doing a talk there. And there she is again. And this went on for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And she started emailing me saying, "Dear Peter, I like that black T-shirt you're wearing. I like the way you smiled at me." And then she got bolder and she started buying a book. And she'd buy the same book every event I did. And she must have bought 20 copies of every book.
Mm-hmm.
Can't be getting the bestseller list. And she'd be sending me 5 to 20 emails a day. And then about 5 years into this, and she'd apologize. She wasn't going to be able to make it so much. She said, "Dear Peter, I won't be able to come to your talk in Birmingham on Wednesday. I hope it'll be okay if I'm not there to support you." "Yeah, it'll be fine, thanks." And then about 5 years on, she sent me a photograph of her Peter James collection. And it was literally an entire wall of everything. Pictures, covers of every book I'd ever written, photographs of me taken with a long lens coming out of restaurants and... And with candles burning at each end. That was when I went to my kind of contacts at the police. And they said, well, they checked her out. And they came out and said, she hasn't got a record, so we can't really do a lot unless she kills you.
So you know who she is. You know where she lives.
Yeah. And then what happened was, this went on for another 2.5 years. And then about 2.5 years ago, I was doing a signing down actually, I was up in Newcastle originally. I think she'd first been. And you sometimes get face blind in signings and you don't recognize people.
Mm.
And she'd changed her hairstyle. I didn't recognize her. And I said, "What name would you like in the book?" She goes, "Mine!" and storms off. And she sends me a 10,000 word long email. "I've been your number one fan for the past 10 years. I can't believe you didn't recognize me." Boom, boom, boom. I didn't hear her again for another 2 years. And then when Not Dead Yet, the book, came out in England in June, I was doing a signing, and suddenly the book slams down in front of me. And I look up, and it's her. And she said, I've decided to forgive you.
Mm.
But since she bought the book, I haven't heard a word from her, so maybe she recognizes herself as a stalking character. You were just saying about being in Beverly Hills. It's kind of, I did some of my research out here because Beverly Hills, Hollywood, Bel Air has more celebrities per square centimeter than anywhere else on planet Earth. And the LAPD actually have, believe it or not, a celebrity stalking team. They call it the Threat Management Unit. And I met the chief of this unit. He's a very nice guy called Chief Louis Moore. And he gave a great comment. He said, you know, Peter, a problem with a lot of these A-list folk is these are high-voltage people who create their own weather.
Oh, my. Well, that certainly goes a long way towards explaining your creation of the stalker in your new novel, Not Dead Yet. Set the stage for our listeners. Tell them what's going on. A movie's being made in Brighton.
Yeah, Brighton, which is where I live and it's where I base my novels, is a seaside city. And it was made fashionable. It's probably the best-known resort in the UK, and it was made fashionable by King George IV. And he had a mistress called Maria Fitzherbert, who he was not allowed to marry because she was Catholic. And so he actually had to have an arranged marriage. And he made Brighton his sort of patch. He built this extraordinary palace there. And he was the one that really put Brighton on the map. And in my story, there's a big movie being made about the love affair between King George IV and his mistress. It's all set in 1780 to kind of 1815. And I have this character called Gaia. And she's like, if you think sort of cross between Madonna and Lady Gaga, you're on the right track.
Mm.
And she's a rock star turned actress and desperately wants a really good role that could become an Oscar nomination. And everybody's talking about this movie that's going to be made as The New King's Speech. So she fights really hard to get the role. And she is warned off by an anonymous kind of email. This is like the first page of the book. And is warned, don't take the part. And she takes the part and somebody tries to kill her before she leaves Los Angeles. Roy Grace, my detective in Brighton, is informed by the LAPD that they don't know who this person is, but they feel that he may well follow her to England and strike again. So Roy Grace has to protect Gaia while she's on his patch in Brighton for the making of the film. And what he doesn't know is that she actually has an obsessive fan in Brighton who is convinced that Gaia is secretly in love with her. You know, every time she sees Gaia on television, she knows that Gaia is actually sending eye signals to her. And she knows that when Gaia puts on a certain combination of clothes, you know, that's just for her. And she's planning to go and meet her, and they're going to consummate their love affair. Of course, Gaia doesn't even know who she is, and it's going to have disastrous consequences.
And the stalker has this, as you described for your own stalker, this shrine, this room with all this stuff, this paraphernalia that has been bought on eBay and various other places, and there's a whole group of these cult-like followers, these groupies that compete with each other to buy the stuff. And this really is reality, isn't it?
Yeah, part of the idea for the book also came from a couple I met about 3 years ago living up in the north of England. And he's a radio presenter, and she's a perfectly kind of nice lady. She's in her early 30s. She works for a law firm. But since she was her mid-teens, she's been absolutely and utterly obsessed with Madonna. And she has, upstairs in her house, which is two bedrooms knocked into one, is a Madonna shrine. And there's no other word for it. She has spent by her own reckoning, about $450,000 over the last 18 years. Like, she spent everything she's ever earned, and they live on his income. And she just spends her income. She'll buy a front row seat to every single day of a Madonna concert anywhere in Europe. She paid $18,000 for a dress on eBay that Madonna had once thrown into the crowd somewhere. And she keeps it in a plastic bag so it keeps Madonna's body smells in still.
Nice.
Yeah. Tour schedules, and everything's in glass cases and beautifully preserved. It's quite bizarre. And you're right, there's about 24 of these Madonna obsessives around the world. And they kind of, they keep in close contact. They hate each other because they're all bitterly jealous of what each other has. But at the same time, they share information about where Madonna's, where their icon, they call her, where the icon is going to be.
And for those readers who have been following your Roy Grace series, Roy is very much in love with a woman who is would you call her a forensic pathologist?
She's more like a mortuary technician.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the fully correct term in England it will be, a senior mortician.
Or a coroner, perhaps?
Kind of. Not quite as high as a coroner. She's the one that has to kind of prepare the bodies, collect the bodies from wherever they've been found dead. So she's not as high as a coroner, but so she basically runs the city morgue, and that's Roy's kind of big love interest. And she's not kind of, if you like, typical. She's very glamorous. She's very smart. I don't mean that. All city morgue keepers aren't glamorous or smart, but she's sort of, yeah, particularly pretty, and it surprised him the first time he ever met her that she'd be working in such a grim place.
And she's very pregnant, and Roy wants to marry her, but there's that little complication, and you keep going this way on the side with Roy's lost wife who disappeared 10 years before, and I don't want to give too much away about her, but
yeah, when we first meet Roy in the first book in Dead Simple, we learn that his wife Sandy, who he loved and adored, just vanished on his 30th birthday, which was 9 years earlier. And he's continued to function as an effective homicide detective for 9 years, he's hunted high and low for Sandy. You know, he has no idea what happened to her. Did somebody kidnap her? Did she run off with a lover? Did she have an accident and never get found? She commits suicide, and it kind of dogs his life. And I did that because when I first created Roy Grace, I looked and thought really hard about what it is that detectives do, and what a homicide detective does above all else is he solves puzzles. You know, every homicide is a mass of moving parts of hundreds of sometimes thousands of pieces, and the homicide detective's role is to meticulously put those together at the same time as trying to think creatively and think out of the box as to what might have happened. And I thought it'd be interesting to have a homicide detective who's so good at solving these puzzles, and yet he has this huge personal puzzle of his own that he cannot solve. And that's how I came up with the idea of Roy Grace's missing wife. And she's kind of there in the shadows. In each book, we learn a little bit more about what happened, and slowly we start to learn things from her perspective as well as from his.
Mm. Peter James joins us. His book, Not Dead Yet, is officially being published today, and he's in Southern California right now. He's got a book signing tonight in Santa Monica, and right now he's on this radio program talking about this very complicated story, because you have so many different threads going here, and one of the ones that I loved, and I know that you had fun with it, is this movie company and all the weird chicanery going on with these movie makers, these kind of sleazy operators.
I had a lot of fun because the movie business has got a lot. It's a very dishonest business. You know, I spent 30 years of my life in it, on and off, alternating between making films and writing. So I've had a huge first-hand experience of it. And it's because there's such big money at stake in the movies, you get desperate people, and they do desperate things to out of greed. I think more people steal money in the movie business than probably any other business on earth. And you get people, I love the character that I have. He's a sort of, he's about to kind of lose everything, and he's got to put the deal together. And bit by bit, the wheels are falling off the film.
Uh-huh. I love your research. You're always doing research. In fact, didn't you just come from a place where you were doing a little in-depth research?
Yeah, I've just spent this morning in the city morgue in Los Angeles, which is actually very interesting in terms of a contrast to the morgue in Brighton where Roy Grace hangs out, partly because the difference in crime. We don't have kind of the culture of handguns in England that we have in the U.S. So accordingly, we have very few gunshots. And I've actually never seen a gunshot wound. And so I don't know if the word privileged is quite the right word, but they just had a gunshot victim in. So I was taken to see this guy, and it's very strange kind of looking at somebody who was alive yesterday and now sort of lying on a mortuary slab with bullet holes in his chest. But they have a staggering number. I think the LA mortuary is it's either the busiest or the second busiest in the US. They do 7,500 autopsies a year, with between 2,500 and 3,000 of them becoming proven homicides.
Oh my.
So I'm always careful in LA.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, it's interesting. I mean, homicide is, in Brighton, we have about 20 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're real amateurs at it in England.
And that was formerly Britain's crime capital, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it still is. I mean, it's still got, Brighton has always had this sobriquet of crime capital of the UK. And it's got, I mean, Britain, we only have 600 homicides a year in the whole of the UK. So most of our crimes are much more robbery, burglary, domestic violence, drugs. I mean, 80% of the crime in Brighton is drug-related.
Hmm.
And Brighton, where I set the novels, is actually a perfect criminal. If you were a criminal and you wanted to design your perfect place to operate, you'd design Brighton.
Hmm.
I'm not being frivolous. It has this sort of, it's got a major seaport on both sides. It's got miles of unguarded coastlines along the English Channel. It's got a major London airport 30 miles away. A huge kind of road network. Villains want escape routes. So it's got all these escape routes in every direction, including the Channel Tunnel and the Channel ports. Got the largest number of antique shops in the UK, which is great for getting rid of stolen goods. It has two universities, a huge kind of hip arty community, and the largest gay community in the UK. So it's a huge recreational drugs market.
I see.
And it's got the title at the tourist board Never Like Me Using, which is for 11 years running, it's been the injecting drug death capital of the UK.
Ouch.
But it goes back to 1840. Before 1840, Brighton was like a sort of quiet seaside spa town that had become fashionable thanks to King George IV. And then in 1841, they opened the London-Brighton railway line. And London was not a good place to live in the 1800s unless you were fantastically rich. So all the villains thought, hey, we'll get out to the seaside.
Mm-hmm.
Open up shop there. So they brought down cockfighting and prostitution and protection racketeering, and Brighton never looked back or forward.
Mm.
1932, there was a series of bodies found in a left luggage locker in Brighton Station, and it then got the sobriquet of murder capital of the UK. And then it ultimately came known at one time as the murder capital of Europe.
Oh, my.
So it's a nice place to sort of set my books.
Great place for you. Peter James joins us. His new novel is Not Dead Yet. And you have your usual sinuous plot where, as a reader, we're saying, okay, this is the person or this is the person. And there are so many surprises here, and I'm not going to throw out any spoilers, but this guy who is sneaking around and pretends he's an extra, I love this character.
He's
a classic character. We almost kind of sympathize with him in a way.
We first of all hear that he's this guy. My producer character is just getting the film all together, and then he gets this phone call out of the blue saying, "You've stolen my idea. You know, I sent you this idea in. You've stolen it." And of course, he just hangs up and refuses to speak to him. This guy who believes that he gave this company the idea to make this movie decides to go on the warpath and decides to go to England and get revenge. So Roy Grace, my detective, not only has the issue of the obsessive fan and the stalker, but he's about to discover that he's got a very angry man that's determined to try and sabotage the production.
And his potential murder weapon is ingenious, and that's all I'll say about that. Does that murder weapon really exist?
It does.
Okay.
Yeah. Without saying too much, I mean, the whole kind of, a lot of the production of the movie takes place in and around the building, the palace that King George built, which is called the Royal Pavilion. And it's one of the most extraordinary buildings in the world. It's sort of Chinese, Indian, sort of onion dome roofs. But it's stunningly beautiful, and it's got this extraordinary collections of art and furniture, including a chandelier that King George IV had built, and which weighs 1.5 tons and has 16,000, they call droplets, like glass prisms.
Mm.
And he refused to sit under it because he's always scared it was going to come crashing down.
But in the movie, they insist on having a dinner with him sitting under it because this is Hollywood, right?
Absolutely. Yes, one of the favorite bits that makes me smile that I wrote is that, and there is this lady, that the Royal Pavilion gave me a huge amount of help when I was researching it, but it's got this lady who's their senior historian. And I said, telling her the kind of plot of the novel, and there's a scene in which George IV sits underneath it, and it's where he's going to sort of end his relationship with his mistress. And she said, yes, but you have to realize that Mariah Fitzherbert never sat under it because it wasn't there at that time. They terminated before that.
Hmm.
And I said, yeah. I said, but that's the point. I want the film producers to completely mess around with history because that's what movie producers do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got this scene in the book which I absolutely love, and when this curator historian based on her says to the producer Larry, says, this couldn't have happened. He goes, yeah, but this is a movie, lady.
Right. Peter James joins us. His new novel is Not Dead Yet. It's the latest Roy Grace novel, and I don't expect you to answer this, but I have to think the next book is going to be about the missing wife.
Well, I've just finished the next book. It's called Dead Man's Time. It'll be out next year, and it's actually, there's something quite interesting that's emerging about her in it. But I'm not saying more about that than that.
Okay, well, we don't want to spoil it for readers and listeners, but I that's just my guess that we're going to get some kind of resolution going here, but we'll see. We'll be waiting for that one.
Yeah, I'm bringing quite a lot of New York history into this new one, actually, as well. It starts in New York in 1922.
Oh,
that moves forward to the present time.
So how many books in this series now, if we include that one that's coming out next year?
That will be the ninth.
Okay.
In the series. Dead Simple was the first, and Not Dead Yet is the eighth.
Okay.
But I don't. I have no plans to end. I'm really having fun writing the series. So as far as I'm concerned, and thanks to the support of lovely folk like you, at the moment I'm certainly planning to carry on for the foreseeable future.
Well, I love these books, and I was fortunate enough to get a little press clipping enclosed with the galley that your publicist sent out, and it's got a lot of blurbs that don't appear on the actual book. And one of them is a blurb that was written for Dead Man's Grip, and I wrote this for the Dayton Daily News, and I totally agree with it today. I have a quote here. It says, "Peter James's stuff is clever, funny, morbid, and always entertaining. Page turners, everyone."
Aw.
And I'll stand by that. It's really true.
Thank you.
These are books that it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and I say, okay, time to go to bed, and I can't put the book down. I just keep turning those pages. And you don't write short books.
No, I mean, I like to be able to get into a meaty story. I think that, you know, I enjoy writing multiple strand stories. And I think that a book always has a kind of, for me, a natural length. You know, I'm quite a brutal editor. I don't like to overwrite. But I like to kind of, I guess, give my readers a good ride. And I always, if I'm reading a short book, I sort of feel kind of cheated at the end. But, you know, when I first started writing years ago, back in I wrote a really bad spy thriller back in 1981. It was a really thin book. And I was at my sales conference, and the sales manager on the publisher said, "Peter, would you mind writing a thicker book next time? Because they cost the same amount of money for the public to buy, and they feel they're getting better value with a thicker book."
Well, Peter, we really appreciate your time today.
It's a pleasure, Vic. It's always great to talk to you. Thank you.
The book is Not Dead Yet. Peter James wrote it. And you've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks. What a pleasure to have Peter James back on the program. Be sure to tune in next week when we reconnect with James Church, one of our more mysterious guests, because that's not really his name. And there's a rumor that he might be a CIA agent, but we just don't know. Next week, we'll be talking to him about his latest Inspector O novel. It's called A Drop of Chinese Blood. James Church returns to the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.